We're now going to this banquet's featuring a discussion which we are much looking forward to with Senator Kyle and Governor Ducey, and I am going to introduce both of them briefly. Senator Kyle has served in the Senate from 1987 to 2013, and then again briefly replacing Senator McCain. He was on the Judiciary Committee much or most of that time. He had a strong reputation for integrity and competence. But I'd also say two other things. One, he's been very good to us as an organization, and we're very appreciative. He's done quite a number of things for us, and we really want to take this opportunity to thank him. And the second thing is, I happened to hear him actually last night at another thing talking, and one of the things he said, talking about all the Senate stuff, et cetera, was consistent with something we've tried to tell our students. He talked about the importance in the Senate of sticking to your guns and everything, but being nice. And we talk about how important it is for our students to be effective in getting the ideas heard, to be the nicest guys on campus. So I appreciate Senator Kyle in that regard, and I did want to say thank you for that. Governor Ducey was elected in 2014 and has followed a pattern which used to be standard and no longer is. He actually had a highly successful and very impressive career before he entered politics. This is kind of what the framers had in mind, you know. You do a lot of good things, then you serve in politics. Anyway, but he built a wonderful company that has a sweet spot in my heart, to say the least, called Stone and Creamery, which is, that sort of was very impressive. He's committed in the state, took care of a $1 billion deficit. He's committed to opportunity for all. He's also committed, and this is relevant to us, and we're talking briefly at the table about it, he's committed to appointing judges who are originalists and textualists. He's done a great job with that so far. He wants judges who will interpret the law. So with all that, I call up both Governor Ducey and Senator Kyle.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
What a great crowd. First of all, Professor, I want to congratulate you for the award, the Stone Award, and would recommend reading for the students to consider the basis for the award, Natan Sharansky's book, The Case for Democracy, about self-censorship. Your remarks were well on target with respect to the challenge that we all face in our society today of self-censoring, when in fact we should speak out. And we're counting on all of you to be speaking out in the future.
Well, thank you, Senator Kyle. And the first thing I want to say is thanks so much to the Federalist Society for having me here tonight. I want to welcome you all to Arizona. We're thrilled to have you. I want to say, as a proud alumni of Arizona State University myself, I want to congratulate I want to congratulate Grant Frazier and John and Stacy and Madalena for bringing the Federalist Society here so we can show off the good things that are happening in the state of Arizona.
I want to switch back now to something we don't think about so much, and that is the role of the in this case, the governor of Arizona, and selecting the judges who sit in the state of Arizona. We have a system in which a commission recommends nominees to the governor, who then makes the appointments to the Superior Court, the trial court, to the Court of Appeals in the state, and to our state Supreme Court. And it's a very significant, this is a big deal for the governor to make these appointments. And so I'd like to go through a little bit of the process, Governor, of how you do this, what you take into account, what you talk to the nominees about, and so on. But I'd like to ask you some specific questions. First of all, just generally, the role that judges have played during, you've now had one entire term, and you're just beginning your second term as governor. And what, how would you characterize the role that judges have played in your administration?
Well, whenever you're a governor, there's going to be certain things where there's litigation on things that you're trying to move forward. I guess my takeaway from that is I would encourage collaboration rather than litigation. When some of these issues like Proposition 123, which is a statewide issue, gets inside the courts, all kinds of things can happen when some justices that have not been trained in this type of background get involved. So it's been, as someone who coming from the business sector, I always wanted to find settlement versus litigation.
So what is your process for considering judges? Now, the commission actually sends you a list of names for each of these positions. What do you do when you get the list?
So the commission will present me with names. I asked the commission, and I think they have treated me fairly, is that they give me more names rather than less. And then we conduct a very thorough background on the nominees. I've been blessed with Annie Foster's here tonight, who's my general counsel. Annie's predecessor was Mike Liberti and Kate King, and we talked about how we could find the best possible people. I don't really like the word legacy. I think it makes it too much about the individual, but when you're talking about selection for the court, these are legacy picks. These are people that almost all will outlive the term of the governor. So it's not only in terms of a very thorough background on the resume, record, references, but it's then the interview process. And certainly on all of the Supreme Court justices, I've done all the interviews personally. And I would say for the first 3 years, I did all the interviews personally in addition to my team, who would provide a lot of input on this so that we could come with the best possible selections.
Do you end up having any particular litmus tests, questions that you ask these judges?
There's no litmus test, but we do ask what the judicial philosophy is of the candidate. I always start out the interview saying, I've got about 40 questions for 40 minutes. Typically in an interview, I like to spend half the time getting to know you and the other half of the time you can get to know me. But in judicial selection, we're going to spend the entire time getting to know you. There'll be some time for questions at the end, and we don't need to get to all 40 questions, but the more I know about how you would answer these questions, the better equipped I am to make a final decision. And it starts with a bit around judicial philosophy. And then I think some of my questions have gotten out into the marketplace because people have come in better prepared. But there aren't necessarily right answers to some of the questions, like, you know, who's your favorite current sitting Supreme Court justice and why? What president best represents your political philosophy and why? What's your favorite part of the United States Constitution? And the same for the Arizona Constitution. I'm curious as to what books have influenced someone's life as well. So I want to get an idea of their thought process. And what I was saying to Gene, I said, at net, what I'm really trying to find out is, does someone want to be a judge, or would they be better equipped running for the legislature? And if they want to be a judge, that's the person I want to select. If they want to make policy, they should go run for office.
Yeah, hear, hear. One of the things that... One of my former colleagues in the Senate, throughout the confirmation process of Justice Kavanaugh, kept raising this matter of the statistics that he had figured out, where Kavanaugh had ruled for corporations, I'm just going to make the number up, but let's say 80% of the time, and ruled for the people 20% of the time, and that was an outrageous statistic in his mind. In other words, it's all about how the case came out. And I've forgotten who recently said, if some of your decisions don't trouble you, you're not doing your job. I gather that do you actually talk about originalism and textualism in your
questions? Well, I put the ball in the candidate's court and say, talk to me about your judicial philosophy. Of course, words like originalism, textualism, strict constructionist, those types of things, and then, you know, tell me more about that. I'll also ask which of the branches did the founders intend to be the least dangerous? And I have to tell you, I am shocked at how many folks do not know their Federalist Papers. Mm. Not the people that are on the Arizona bench over the last 5 years.
Do you have any interesting or funny stories, or I shouldn't say funny, but interesting, anything in particular that stands out in your mind about some of these answers?
Well, I think one of the funnier stories were I had a real opportunity in my first year of an opening on our Supreme Court, and we went through a very thorough interview process of the seven candidates, and when I called the candidate up to tell them that they had been selected for appointment to the Supreme Court, they accidentally hung up on me. And that happened to be Clint Bullock.
Would it be unfair to ask why on earth you appointed Clint Bullock to the Supreme Court?
Well, I will say I wish that we would have interviewed, or we would have taped the interview that I conducted with Clint, and his answers on each of the questions around judicial philosophy, different cases that the court had ruled on, his favorite part of the United States Constitution, the Arizona Constitution, and then the other factors that had influenced his life. There were seven very high-quality candidates, several of which, after Clint Bullock, it was John Lopez and Andy Gould. But I knew that there was a clear pick, and it was because of Clint's knowledge and background, and not only in terms of the interview process, it was the process that we conducted before that, but I would also say Clint's reputation in the legal community. The number of adversaries that he had that had come to me and said, I don't agree with Clint Bullock on anything, but I can't tell you what an affable individual this is that has the highest standards of ethics and personal conduct. And that is who Clint Bullock is.
Collegiality matters a lot. Yep. Well, we kid about Clint because he's one of our own, and thank goodness that he's on our Supreme Court.
And the letter that George Will wrote for Clint was also something I'll treasure. Very impressive.
The theme of this conference is economic liberty, and there's so much that we could talk about in the concept, and I want to get into some of that because your administration has been characterized by some really significant changes in the fabric of Arizona society and in particular our economy, which has stood our state in great stead in terms of attracting people to come to the state and making it a place where people who are here have enjoyed a great deal of economic prosperity. I want to quote one thing Justice Scalia once wrote and just get your idea on it before I get into some other things. He said, it seems to me the difference between economic freedom and what are generally called civil rights turns out to each a difference of degree rather than of kind. Well, that's a rather obtuse statement. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I would say that I agree with Justice Scalia that the idea of economic liberty is intended in the words our inalienable rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And certainly this idea of pursuing your course in life as you see fit, whether that's as an entrepreneur or as a business person, has been something that many people that have been in positions like mine or in legislative positions have used their power to stifle competition or to shut down markets or to limit opportunity. In this country, and I think it's one of the best things that someone that believes in the philosophy that you believe in as an elected official can make right and can fix. I mean, we both enjoy some of the great traditions of being Arizonans, and we very much value the Federal Society. We very much value the memory of Barry Goldwater. As well, and that resides in the Goldwater Institute. And I always think people in my there's a number of things. If you're going to be on our senior staff in the governor's office, I'm going to expect you to have read. And one is Conscience of a Conservative, and Senator Goldwater said that he did not run for office to pass laws. He ran for office because he wanted to repeal laws. And I think as I look at economic liberty and the amount of regulations that are on the books, I'll give you an example. I wanted to know how many regulations. We all know about the federal registrar, but there are 50 state registrars of regulations. And even as governor with a crackerjack senior staff, it took us some time to call together the amount of regulations in the state of Arizona. We finally came with a total number of 11,000 regulations. I was able to say in my second state of the state, we would like to get rid of unnecessary and outdated regulations. We called on the entrepreneurs of Arizona to let us know what regulations were getting in their way, and we've been able to eliminate. And this is something, there's a certain peer pressure amongst elected officials of what have you done, what law have you passed. If you ever go to a legislative district meeting, the electeds will stand up and talk about the laws. It's almost like they need to score 2 points or score 4 points or score 8 points. But we've been able to say that we've eliminated 1,098 regulations struck from the books in Arizona. It's the equivalent of a $78 million tax cut without affecting the general fund $1.
We're here. And I think some of the, and it may be not just regulations, but the regulatory boards, Arizona has been leading in eliminating requirements to conduct businesses, has it not? In other
words, we have
the licensure kind of regulatory regime.
We have been leading on that, and we are doing our best. I will tell you, many of these boards and commissions, what is it Ronald Reagan said about there's nothing like eternal life in the federal government? So we've been working hard. We've waived the licenses that are necessary for someone that's at 200% of the poverty line. We're working on universal recognition of licenses. Arizona's, you're in Maricopa County right now. This is the fastest growing county in the country, 2 years running, and one of the largest counties in the country too. So I think that's a real positive. People vote with their feet, and people are moving to the state of Arizona. So we want to pass in this legislative session something called universal recognition of occupational licenses. We don't think that someone loses their skills because they pack up a U-Haul truck in Chicago, Illinois, and move to Arizona. Yet we've got some of the bullies on these boards and commissions. We've already done that for military spouses. So if you're a military spouse, you come here, you can go right to work. But why wouldn't we do that for everyone? And we do have some of these folks on these boards and commissions that will say, no, you can't work here. You haven't paid the piper. With universal recognition of occupational licenses, and I'm looking at Shauna Bullock, who serves in our House of Representatives, and I know she'll be a champion on this. Yes. We have a real opportunity here. And that'll be another way that Arizona can show that it's going to lead the nation on these types of reforms.
And that's the essence of economic liberty.
Yes.
And I'm sure that in many respects, these are the jobs that there are a lot of different names for the hardworking Americans who are not at the very top of the ladder. This is how they make their living. And it's something that people who love liberty ought to be promoting. And this ties into something else I wanted to ask you about, going back to the AEI World Forum that we attended. One of the themes of this, the American Enterprise Institute was created back, I think, in the 30s to celebrate the role of enterprise in the United States, to demonstrate that businesses create jobs, they produce products that are important to the people and are the wealth creation engine of our country, and that enterprise needs to be fostered and celebrated. And the American Enterprise Institute has a theme, which is that the whole point of enterprise is opportunity and dignity for everyone, and that specifically emphasizes the employees. And I was struck at this last conference by the difference between this attitude and the view of some on, I don't even want to say the left today, this progressive movement that fosters or that speaks of socialism, as if somehow that's the friend of the working person, as opposed to the free market system, which has raised, 2 billion people out of poverty. You heard many of the same presentations I did. What was your, and particularly since you're practicing that right here in the state of Arizona, what was your reaction to that?
Well, I do think that we need to do a better job of communicating what makes our system work, why we are the most prosperous country in the history of the world, and how this happened. And not only have we done incredible things for our citizens here in the United States, I would say that economic liberty has been our greatest export. Our values, which our founders instilled in the Declaration and the Constitution, this is what has lifted 2 billion people around the world out of poverty. And there's no government program that could ever be created that could reflect the results of what we've seen from the American free market entrepreneurial system. And I think it just shows the truth in Ronald Reagan's parting comments to us, that freedom is not passed down through the bloodstream. And we do have some work to do. I would really encourage the young people on college campuses. And Professor Bray, I want to say how impressed I was with your comments, and congratulations on the Joseph Story Award. The only challenge I would give to those comments is there are some in your ranks that are incredible communicators. And some of them do become somewhat celebrities, like I would offer Antonin Scalia. And if you ever watch the 60 Minutes interview with Justice Scalia, it's incredibly compelling as to why our Constitution is a contract. And I know there are those among you, and actually when I offered Clint, I said, Clint, we're going to be peers, and it's going to be a separate and co-equal branch, and you'll be a justice, and I will be the governor. But I really hope that if you accept this nomination, that you will get out in front of young people and help make the case for these ideas. Because I do think we have to persuade more people to what really works. Peggy Noonan wrote a great article in the Wall Street Journal saying, many my age and older, we believe in our system because we saw the Berlin Wall come down. We saw freedom and liberty succeed around the world. Many young people don't buy into our system because they saw the economy come down in 2008. And we saw a lot of pundits and commentators on cable news networks saying things like, now we know that the market does not work, with no one challenging them. I mean, if anything, we've never had more evidence that the market works by what happened in 2008 and the subsequent comeback, but we do need to allow our citizens to come along with it. That's why we're wiping out occupational licensing and opportunities. My concern, I ran on a theme of opportunity for all of our citizens. And our folks at the top are doing just fine. They're going to continue to do fine. Mitch Daniels, who is one of my favorite governors in Indiana and someone I talked to before I made the decision to run for office, used to say, we have the haves and the soon to haves. And we have to think about the people that are on the first rung of the economic ladder and the second run. And that is really hard when the economy's flat or not growing or we're in something called secular stagnation, whatever that means. But right now, our economy is booming. And it's not just in Arizona, it's roaring across the country. Any governor you talk to will say that they have more jobs available than they have people to fill them. So there's never been a better time for policymakers to reform and us to promote economic liberty, entrepreneurship, and prosperity through our policies.
I hope that all of you as soon-to-be lawyers appreciate the role of the rule of law in this great economic success. It underpins the whole concept of economic freedom is premised on the notion of a set of rules that everyone understands they abide by in order to make this system work. And many of them are as second nature as stopping at, you know, the red light on the stop sign, and when it goes green, then you go. Our economy is governed by literally hundreds of legal principles that enable us to ensure that we can trust each other in economic matters, that there are dispute resolution mechanisms and all the rest that enable us to extend credit and all the rest of it. And that is missing in a lot of other countries in the world. You all have a great role to play in making this system work by ensuring that the people who participate in the commerce of the country are able to make this system work, to ensure that the contracts that they make are properly enforced, and where there is a need for redress of grievances, to be able to go to court and to do that, and to uphold these standards of law which underpin the concept of economic freedom. Freedom relies on legal principles.
I want to touch on that a little bit. You are all trained in the law with a legal background. My background was in business, and my company was Cold Stone Creamery. And while we grew Cold Stone to 1,440, thank you. I never get tired of hearing that. I always say you get a lot of undeserved popularity when you're selling ice cream. It all goes away when you balance your first budget. But if you think about it, even though we built it into a large brand that operates in 31 countries around the world, we did it one store at a time, one franchise at a time. And each one of those franchises had a contract with that franchisee. And the rule of law, the miracle of the rule of law in this country, is how well that agreement works. I think many on the left like to discount McDonald's and Subway and these franchise companies that have done such a good job as giving people their first job. I know I was trained, I was a busboy at Bob Evans. But those jobs, those entrepreneurs are able to go out into the marketplace with their idea for a better concept because our franchise laws work. And that's one example of the thousands of different components under our legal system. But I want you to know that when you do go overseas, you don't franchise. You find one partner in a country like China or Japan or South Korea or Taiwan. Because the contract, and this is the top folks at McDonald's advising me on how to take the brand international, the contract is not worth the paper it's written on if you get into a dispute. So you have to have that partnership. Now, of course, you want to find partnership. That's the objective when you're making franchisee selection. But oftentimes, things can go wrong. And when they do, that contract works. And that's a real testament to our system.
Yeah. I, in thinking about this idea of economic freedom, the theme for the conference here, I was reminded of a book by an author whose name is Hernando de Soto, originally from Peru. He wrote several books, one of which was El Otro Sendero, or The Other Path. And this book was a result of research he did into the subject of how law could create economic growth and freedom. He studied the system, for example, in his home country of Peru and then went to other countries like Egypt. And he found that while there were millions of people living in on little plots of land and also setting up little shops of one kind or another, they didn't have any title to the land on which they were selling their produce or on which the little shack was located. They had no economic ability, therefore, to leverage the value of anything, of any real estate, for example. There was no legal system for recording the ownership of this property. The wealthy had theirs, and they protected it through the political system, and that was that. And he helped to set up a situation in Peru in which there were actually titles, deeds to land, and people who were on a particular area were able to record this in a central place. This is all second nature to all of us, but it didn't exist in a country like that. Once the little shopkeeper had a title to land, he had the ability to take that piece of paper to the bank and say, I need a loan for my business. I'm going to really expand this business and so on. And of course, the rest is history. The point is that economic freedom depends upon the rule of law. And it depends upon all of the things that you have been taught in law school and probably take for granted. I know I have a tendency to take it all for granted. But it really needs to be protected, and protecting it means it needs to be defended in the political sphere in our country, because there are those who have a different notion that maybe this doesn't really matter. I doubt that they really have any understanding or appreciation of it, is my thought. But Governor, I was going to ask you, I mean, you've gone through this in creating a business based upon a lot of legalities and a lot of help from lawyers and the like. And would you have a word of encouragement to people who are going to be participating in that system very soon about how to make that case to others, particularly young people who don't appear to have the experience to understand how the rule of law is such an important basis for economic freedom and prosperity in our country, as well as dignity and opportunity for all of the people who work in the system?
Well, of course, Senator. I think I'm sure I'm with some of the smartest young people and students in the nation here. And I think this idea of persuading, of bringing people to our side, of people understanding. You're someone who taught me that leaders are truly teachers. So you are becoming masters in your subject matter. And oftentimes you are going to be smarter, possess more knowledge than the other people inside the room. My challenge to you would be, who can you persuade inside the room? Who can you bring along? What questions can you ask that may challenge someone's preconceived notion or knowledge that isn't quite that deep? Because I am concerned there is a real hostility to our system and the things that we hold dear, the values that have given us this incredible gift. And we're going to be challenged on this front going forward in the next several years and beyond. But it is somewhat shocking to me, some of the ideas that have entered the political landscape. Just in the few years that I've been in public life, we're not so much arguing the center right and the center left. Many of the ideas, many of the candidates, many of the thoughts that are being expressed on the extreme left are not only unaffordable, they are unworkable, and they are not a reflection of a belief in the rule of law and property rights and an adherence to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, or even an ideal that this is in the, for a more perfect union. These are collectivist ideas that are unaffordable and would not work, but would give all the power, or nearly all the power, to the people in Washington, D.C.
Well, I've taken my shot at the left. Now let me turn attention to something where the governor and I have a little different point of view on the matter of trade. But Governor Ducey sits in a position of knowing exactly what the benefits of trade with a foreign country are to a state like Arizona, which is right on the border with our major trading partner, Mexico. Would you, Governor, speak a little bit to the question of, I still call it NAFTA, I can't even remember the name of the other thing it's called, but the North American Free Trade Agreement that was negotiated a long time ago by President Clinton, approved by the Congress, and created a great trading regime between Mexico, Canada, and the United States. That's now been renegotiated in some respects and is pending, or will be pending, when it's submitted to the Congress. And I would say, unfortunately, I'm not very sanguine about its prospects of being approved by the Congress, both because of the Democratic Party's view against these kinds of free trade agreements and an increasing number of Republicans who seem to have the same point of view.
Well, I'm a free trader. And I've been curious as to what exactly the definition of free and fair trade is. Larry Kudlow said at the National Governors Association that the president's definition of free trade was no tariffs, no barriers, and no subsidies. And I said, sold, Larry, I'll take it. That's not where we are yet. I do think the USMCA, the United States-Mexico-Canada agreement, is an improvement on NAFTA, especially as a border governor. There's all kinds of issues we have to deal with as a border state. But first and foremost, separating out the issues you see every day in the news, Mexico is our number one trading partner in Arizona, and it's not even close. They are our number one trading partner times four. My first visit, international visit, as governor 4 years ago was to Mexico City. My first visit upon re-election was to Mexico City. So I am calling on our Congress to ratify the USMCA. I think this is important. We're incredibly lucky to have neighbors like Canada and Mexico who are partners, friends, and allies. And I'm concerned about that. I'm concerned about the politics that are, we shouldn't be in election cycle right now in March of 2019. But I fear in many ways that we are. The Governor's Council is this will sound self-serving, so I want to be careful how I say it. But you're never going to see two governors split screen on cable TV yelling at each other. Okay, governors are different because we're chief executives. No one knows who Doug Ducey is outside of the state of Arizona. And I really saw this when John Hickenlooper was the Democrat governor of Colorado. When I was first elected, John Hickenlooper didn't want Barack Obama running Colorado any more than I wanted him running Arizona. And in the governor's council, when we can agree on an issue like that the National Guard should not be federalized, we're able to get 50 governor's signatures on a letter that goes to Congress, and it makes a difference in stopping that kind of mentality, that centralization mentality that can sometimes happen in Washington, D.C. And I was hopeful that we'd have 50 governor's signatures on a letter that said we'd love to do the USMCA and we'd love to talk, you know, deeper about infrastructure. And then politics intervened. And this is in 2019. So I'm going to do my best to advocate for this ratification. I think it's important for North American free trade. And I think having a prosperous and peaceful North America is in all of our best interest, and I think through the successful ratification of this, we can not only, there will be no way that we stop talking about the southern border in our country, but we should be talking more about the southern border in Mexico and how that's affecting us as well.
Well, Gene is just about to bring the hook out, so my final question is this. There are a great many very bright, soon-to-be successful, aspiring lawyers here in the audience tonight. Is there any reason you can think of that they should come to the state of Arizona, Governor?
Well, just know, I mean, it's not only is it beautiful here in terms of quality of life and economic opportunity, I was able to say in my third state of the state that I would be remiss if I didn't thank my partner in growing Arizona's economy, and that's been California Governor Jerry Brown. And just know if you come to Arizona, you will enjoy lower taxes and light regulation and a place that will be a place of opportunity for all. We'd love to have you here, but even more so, the things that Senator Kyle touched on, the things that you know through the Federalist Society. Go forward and bring other young people along. At least be part of that conversation and that persuasion. That's what will make the biggest difference. That's where we'll be sitting here sometime a decade into the future talking about how we navigated through this time where people were talking about ideas that we knew wouldn't work, and we'll be in a country of peace and prosperity with a bright future for everyone here and all of our kids and grandkids.
Thank you, Governor Doug Ducey.